for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and joining me today is author Theodore Cohen. He is here to talk about his new book, Frozen in Time, Murder at the Bottom of the World. So Dr. Cohen, or Ted as he likes to be called, holds 3 degrees in the physical sciences from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has been an engineer and scientist for more than 40 years. Born and raised in southern Wisconsin, he now lives with his wife, Susan, in eastern Pennsylvania, close to his children and grandchildren who live in New York and New Jersey. Ted has published more than 350 papers, articles, columns, essays, and interviews in scientific and popular literature. His first novel was Full Circle, A Dream Denied, A Vision Fulfilled, and was published by Author House in 2009. Frozen in Time, Murder at the Bottom of the World was recently released by Author House, and this novel is based in part on Ted's participation in the 16th Chilean expedition to the Antarctic in 1961 and 62. And interestingly enough, in October of 1964, the U.S. Board of Geographic Names named the geographical feature Cohen Islands in the Cape Legupo, I'm going to have to see if that's the right pronunciation, that area of Antarctica, in his honor. So I am just thrilled to have Ted on the program today. Welcome, Ted.
Well, thanks, Juanita. Yes, you got that right, Cape Legupo.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. So how great is it to have an island named after you?
Well, there's actually 4 little ones, and it's great. I hope they're still above water. I mean, they were. There's one big one and 3 little ones, and they're all tucked in this little group just off the Antarctic Peninsula, but they're pretty low-lying, so if they're still above water, that's great.
Have you ever put your foot down on them?
Yes. I mean, I may have been the first one to step on them, but they're not exactly the kind of place that you would retire to.
I guess not. Well, I would love to hear a little bit more about your experience in Antarctica. I mean, it's so directly linked to your novel. So maybe tell us a little bit about your personal time there, and then maybe paint a picture of what the landscape, what it really is like there, because I think most of us just think ice.
Well, it was pure serendipity that I ended up there. I, as you know, from what you've read about me, I switched majors in college from engineering to letters and science, had to go back and take a number of courses, including geology, and the person who was running a lab happened to be a person who was doing work in the Antarctic. He invited me to go with him, and it was just the opportunity of a lifetime. And unlike a lot of people who go to Antarctica for the United States and go down through New Zealand and then across by air into the continent, we were going down with a Chilean expedition out of Punta Arenas, Chile, which is the southernmost city. There are other places further south in that, such as Ushuaia in Argentina, but they're much, much smaller. So we joined the expedition in Punta Arenas, went down the Strait of Magellan and across the Antarctic Ocean into the Antarctic. And it's everything that you really think it is. The Antarctic Peninsula itself, which points up towards South America, is really an island archipelago that is covered with ice, covered with the continental glacier, which, of course, expands during the southern winter and then recedes during the southern summer or the austral summer. And, of course, during our summer up here, it's winter down there and vice versa. So we went down there leaving Punta Arenas in November and spent December, January, February, and early March at just above the Antarctic Circle, working on the peninsula and on the islands. And so quite a bit of the snow and ice had melted from the islands, which was what allowed us to get on them, although the larger ones retained some ice cover. And, of course, the continental glacier itself was covered with ice and snow, sometimes hundreds of feet. And the greatest danger we had was the fact that because the sun was out almost 24 hours a day and the temperatures were warmer, being the summer, when I say warm, I mean the average daytime temperatures were up in the low 30s.
Mm-hmm.
The continental glacier was calving and dropping thousands and thousands of tons of ice and snow into the water constantly, which was jeopardizing our work and certainly in some cases our lives. So I'm sure you can, in your mind's eye, picture the kinds of dangers that we encountered just simply from the ice and the snow. And then, of course, we had to contend with the orcas and the seals, the leopard seals in the water, and the weather, which, whether it was summer or winter, in the winter it's much worse, but even in the summer, the constant storms were just very menacing.
Really bad. Well, what about the wildlife there? You mentioned the orcas. How were they dangerous to you where you were working?
Well, there were orcas in the waters all around us. I was telling my wife the other day who, and by the way, this is sort of biographical. Frozen in Time is sort of biographical, and so the Ted Stone in the book is really Ted Cohn, and the Susan in the book is my wife, Susan.
She is, okay.
But the other characters, if the person is living, I've changed their name. If somebody's passed away, I've used their real name. But I was telling my wife Susan the other day that if I had written this book a year from now, people could accuse me of grabbing this book from ripping it from the headlines.
From today.
Mm-hmm. From today, because there were several things. Such as orca attacks that we know from recent headlines.
The SeaWorld event.
Yes, it is a real event.
Yep.
And there were orca pods in the waters all around the area where we were working. And in some cases, they menaced the little launches that we were using, coming right up to them at times, to the point that some of the Chilenos that we were working with could have put their hands into their blowhole.
Oh, geez. So were they just curious, or did they view you as food?
Well,
or both?
It depends upon where you were. If you were in the boat, I think they were curious. Now, these are really porpoises. They have no sense of smell.
Okay.
But they have very acute eyesight and hearing. So if you're in a boat, they're more curious, and they're drawn by the sound of the motor. If you're dragging a seal behind you, you've got a problem because they see, you know, if you've shot a seal and you're dragging it back to the base to feed the dogs, as happened, and they want that seal, you've got a problem. The problem that we had, and we had to be very careful of, is imagine that you're standing on a small iceberg, and the sun is up, and you're casting a shadow. Now, that shadow looks, if you're an orca underneath the ice, that shadow looks like a seal lying on the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And so orcas tend to want to flip the iceberg, flip the seal in the water, and take the seal.
Okay, yeah.
So you pretty well can get the picture.
I get the picture.
You get the picture.
It's not a good picture.
Yeah, so we had to be very careful of the orca pods and the leopard seals that that frequented the waters around where we were working. And this is all brought out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, the type of books I write in Frozen in Times 1 and the first novel that I wrote are basically, I call them chimeras. They're combinations of two things. They're a combination of a novel and almost like a research paper, if you will, because they have footnotes.
That's right. It's very unique to your writing.
Right. They're not the typical novel. And And I write that way to help the reader. And I do that because years and years ago, my poor wife was trying to read Jurassic Park. And every night she would come to me and ask me to explain things to her, like, what is chaos theory? Explain chaos theory to me. And explain genetic engineering and explain cloning. And I sensed that she was completely frustrated trying to read this obviously bestseller, a very, very good book, because she was trying to understand what this author was talking about. And I vowed, if I ever wrote a novel, and of course this was years and years ago, that I would try to help the reader understand some of the concepts, some of the principles, and some of the background. And so when I wrote Full Circle, which was my first novel last year, which is a more typical novel, and now Frozen in Time, which is what we call, or what I think is a more postmodern novel, it's loaded with footnotes. In fact, there's almost 200 footnotes in Frozen in Time. Mm-hmm. And this may be fiction in part, but believe me, you can take what's in the footnotes as gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And there are addresses, internet addresses in there that you can go to, which will actually show how orcas in a pod will get together to go after seals on ice and try and tip an iceberg over.
Wow, that's fascinating.
So it's really meant to help the reader gain an appreciation for the backstory, if you will.
I think it's really unique and such a great idea. And, you know, when you weave fact like that into a fiction novel, it just creates that much more excitement for the reader. And you really, you include some of your own personal photographs. You have maps.
Yes.
So it kind of leaves the reader wondering, too.
Well, there are two maps in there that show the area that we were working in. There's also a really good map, the first map ever drawn of Deception Island. There are 8 photographs, many of which I took. I'll tell you a funny story. One of my editors was Michael Garrett, who happened to be Stephen King's first editor.
Oh, wow.
And Michael edits books to prepare them for submission to conventional publishing houses. And so he sent back my book after he edited it. And he said, you know, you really need to lose the footnotes and the picture.
Oh, no.
Because he said novels don't have footnotes and picture.
Yeah, well, you didn't take his advice, clearly.
Well, my wife said, what are you going to do? I said, well, this is not your typical novel. I'm going to leave the novel the way it is, because I think that the maps and the footnotes and the pictures really do give the reader a sense. For example, there's a picture that I took from a mountain south of Base O'Higgins, where most of this action takes place. And if you look at that picture in the book, I say that the base looks like it was a mining camp on a planet in the far reaches of the universe. You look at that picture and you say, yeah, I mean, here's this little base on a little peninsula jutting out of the Antarctic Peninsula into this sea with icebergs, huge icebergs around, and nothing else in this godforsaken land where the wind chill can go 130, 140, 150 degrees below zero in the winter, where buildings have second-story doors so people can get out. And, you know, you can't, how do you describe that to somebody?
Yeah, you don't, and most people are quite visual.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's a great idea with the photograph. Well, I'd love for you just to comment a little bit about the actual story. You've mentioned Ted, your character, your main character, Ted Stone. So tell us a little bit about the story and some of your main characters, which you have a lot of.
Well, yes. And the fact of the matter is, I've said this is a postmodern novel, and the reason it's a postmodern, there's many reasons why it's a postmodern novel. First of all, ostensibly Ted Stone is a main character, but the fact of the matter is I'm more or less there just to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Other people that you will meet along the way are the three men from the University of Wisconsin with whom I went to Antarctica, the major professor, the man who used to be my lab instructor, and another gentleman. And by the way, we all are still in contact. I exchanged emails with the major professor yesterday and with the former lab instructor this morning.
Do they love your book?
Oh, they loved it. They loved it. The former lab instructor lives in Peru. The professor is Professor Emeritus of Geology at the University of Wisconsin, and the other scientist is a volcanologist these days and spends most of his time in Singapore. And we reconnected just recently, within the last month. I don't think I've seen them since 1964.
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
Yes. I mean, the Internet is wonderful. I'm a scientist by training, and I'll tell you something. I don't think a morning goes by when I turn this computer on that I don't marvel at the Internet and the world that it places at our fingertips.
Yeah, it's amazing how it's connected
just
everything. Yep. Yep.
That's right. So I'm really there to tell this story, and in that way it's a bit unusual. But then we have several characters in the Chilean Navy. We have Captain Munoz, who's the captain of the Lientor, which is a ship. It happens to be a very small ocean-going tug, as a matter of fact, and on that ship are two non-commissioned officers who rob the central bank of Chile following the May 1960 earthquake in Chile. Here again, ripped from the headlines. It turns out that the May 22nd, 1960 Chilean earthquake was the largest earthquake ever recorded by man. It was a 9.5 magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
The recent one was 8.8.
Oh.
So this one was almost a magnitude larger.
That's incredible.
So the pivotal event in the book is the fact that these two non-commissioned officers who were assigned by Captain Munoz to protect the bank after the earthquake robbed the bank. And what they do is pack everything up and ship it south in a crate that is basically in the name of a good friend of one of theirs who is going to be going to the Antarctic as well as they are. The ship is going to the Antarctic as well as one of their friends. And so everybody comes together at Base O'Higgins in the Antarctic on the 16th Chilean expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And we come to learn then how greed overtakes these three people, the two non-commissioned officers and the sergeant, how an officer in the Chilean Navy begins to suspect that these people are involved in the theft, how Ted Stone, my character, comes to find out what is going on here, which places his life in jeopardy, and then the rest of the story unfolds from there.
And
we'll just have to let the
readers read to find out.
what happens.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. I'm talking today with Dr. Theodore Cohen. His new book, Frozen in Time, Murder at the Bottom of the World, is out now. And you can find out more about Ted and his book at his Amazon website. You can look for his book or do a search on his book, Frozen in Time. Well, you know, you really have some powerful underlying themes as well. I mean, you mentioned one about greed. So tell us a little more about the messages that you really wanted to convey that kind of are underneath the plot here, and whether that preceded the actual story when you were formulating it, or you had an idea of the story and the themes came about naturally.
There are certain themes that appear in many of my writings. One of the things that has often initially puzzled me, but I finally was able to work through it, was why do bad things happen to good people? Mm. It really didn't gel until many, many years ago, or not that many perhaps, but if you remember the Indonesian tsunami, and the religious editor of the Washington Post raised that issue in his column and basically decried why all these innocent men, women, and children had to die for something that was obviously out of their control. And he and I then subsequently engaged in a conversation regarding why bad things happen to good people. Well, as it turns out, bad things happen to bad people as well. Bad things just happen. I mean, it's part of our life. And it's been something that has been a part of my writings for these last several years, because I find in some ways that it's a point where science and religion can come together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's discussed in the book. The other thing that I find interesting and that is discussed throughout the book in many different ways is the role that deception plays in our lives. For example, there are games of chess that are played in the book. And in one game, the poison pawn deception is used. And of course, there's a map of Deception Island in the South Shetland Island. So the whole subject of deception in nature and in man and in life is something else that has intrigued me and is used heavily in this book as a theme. And then another theme, it's a minor theme in the sense that I don't weave it in constantly throughout my writings, but I do touch on it in my writings, and that is the debt that we owe the U.S. military and their families. And I try to say something about that. I certainly did in my first novel, where I talk about a very good friend of mine. He's passed away now, a man by the name of Harvey McCoy, who did some brilliant things in the area of communications during World War II. And in Frozen in Time, I talk about an Air Force pilot that I met in Punta Arenas who was shuttling material and personnel back and forth in the early days of the space program, and hadn't seen his wife for many, many months. So it's just paying homage to the military and their families who make tremendous sacrifices day after day after day, and especially now. This isn't World War II where the whole nation is focused on on what's going on in Europe or in the Pacific, where the headlines day after day were devoted. And I remember those days. Now you want to know what's going on in Afghanistan or Iraq or Yemen. You're usually finding it on the 6th, 7th, or 8th page, and you're not really aware of the sacrifices that are made. So that's another theme.
That's interesting. And so those themes are all weaving throughout all of your writings, or that's just kind of in this book?
Well, they may not all be in all of my writing,
okay. But
you will find one or two of them in my writing somewhere.
Gotcha. I'm really curious of how you balance the more analytical side of your personality, which you're very based in science, with the creative side. I mean, here you're now embarking on a novel writing career. You know, most of your writing has been in the technical or nonfiction realm.
Right. Well, that's a good question.
Because it looks to me like you're just going for it. I mean, you're putting out two novels in the course of almost less than 2 years, maybe a year time.
Well, it is. It's a bit of a spurt, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We're quite curious.
What's really amazing about this one, Frozen in Time, was that I wrote the first draft in 3 weeks.
I know. I heard that. I can't even imagine how that's possible, Ted.
Well, it was just, I mean, it literally poured out. And I can't explain it either. I'll tell you a story in a minute, because this has happened once before, but a completely different venue. I woke up one morning last November, and I don't know what it was. I'd been looking at some Antarctic pictures that I wanted converted from 35-millimeter slides to pictures. It was November. I had started writing Frozen in Time in 1962.
Mm.
And then I had written it as a short story that I was going to submit to Playboy magazine, of all places.
Okay.
When I got back to the States, it was handwritten on the back of some radiograms, some blank radiogram forms. And God only knows what happened to them. I mean, it's a long way from the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula to Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Right.
And they were gone. And that was the end of that. And, of course, well, it's a lot of water over the dam between then and now. And I just got up one morning and started writing. And, of course, we went up to New York for Thanksgiving, and I asked my daughter if she had my diary that I kept, a very detailed diary, and she's sort of the person who keeps the family history, and she dug it out and gave it to me, and there were some clippings from some Chilean newspapers and some photographs in there and some notes that I had kept. And I came back, and I just sat down, and in 3 weeks had about 80% of the book down. And you know, I don't know that being analytical necessarily puts you in a straitjacket, because what you do is you get into a situation and then you just sort of let your mind take it wherever it's going to go. I just didn't feel constrained. I just got to a situation and then I said, okay, what are the possibilities here?
Mm-hmm.
And let my mind run. Now, I will tell you this. When I said I wrote it in 3 weeks, this is one of those 80-20 jobs that you hear about. You do 80% of the job and 20% of the time, and you spend the next 80% of the time finishing 20% of the job. and you find that's where the real hard work is. And the hardest part about this was that after I finished the first draft, I did not like the way I was portraying Captain Munoz.
Mm.
I had this great character with a really great and interesting background, and he just didn't seem to be coming up to his full potential. And I needed to do something with him. And I think the most difficult part of writing this book was breathing life into Captain Munoz. And once I started breathing life into Captain Munoz and bringing him to his full potential, then I had to change some of the other characters to make them more menacing, so that the ship, the Lientour, became a real hotbed, if you will. And that's where you find the action, for the most part. Not that there aren't other places where you're going to find it.
And well, it is an action adventure.
It's an action adventure, but it's a thriller, I think.
Yeah.
And I will say this, that there's a lot of fiction in there, but you can believe all of those narrow escapes off the peninsula and on the water. Those really did happen. There were several occasions where Grant Morris, who is that's the name given to my former lab instructor, the fellow who lives in Peru today, where he and I almost lost our lives. There were at least two and possibly three occasions, because storms would come up and it would go from literally 0 to 60-70 miles an hour within minutes.
Unpredictable.
Oh, totally unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Have you been back there?
No.
You haven't? You did your time.
Well, I think I'm destined to, because there's a statue in the middle of the square in Punta Arenas with a foot, and it's right at eye level, and the legend is that if you kiss the toe of the statue, that you will return to Punta Arenas. So I did, and so I think I'll probably end up getting at least back to Punta Arenas, but I don't know if I'll ever quite make it back to the Antarctic.
Yeah.
I would go back.
I
honestly would. I would go back, and I'd go back the same way. I don't know that I'd want to go down through New Zealand and fly into McMurdo or the Pole Station.
It would be interesting to see if anything had changed since you were there last, just considering the climate change that we've experienced, and I think that would be fascinating.
Well, I think the base has been much built out. You can go on the internet, and I do provide the address. There is I know that the Germans have built a site alongside the Chilean base there, and in fact, I think you can even get real time weather at Base O'Higgins.
Oh, wow!
And you can actually see the base. It's a very good site. So the base has certainly expanded from when I was there. It's a very active base, and I'd love to go back. I'd love to go back to Deception Island and see how it was. Deception Island is interesting because it's the sunken cauldron of one of two active volcanoes in Antarctica. And the reason it's called Deception Island is that unless you approach it from the south, it looks like a solid island. But if you come up from the south, there's a very narrow entryway into the center of the island, into the caldera. And fortunately, we went in a few years before the volcano erupted and destroyed. There were inside the island. There was an Argentine base, a Chilean base, and a British base. And then, of course, they were all destroyed a few years after we were there when the volcano erupted.
Mm. That would be fascinating to see for you.
Oh my gosh! Yes. Yeah. And the biggest penguin rookery in the Antarctic is on the southeast side of that island.
Oh, wow.
Hundreds of thousands of penguins.
Oh, wow. Isn't that fascinating? I wonder if that's where they shot What was that penguin movie a few years back?
Oh, no.
The documentary.
No, those are emperor penguins.
Oh, that's right.
So those would be further. Those would be further to the east.
East.
On the other side of the peninsula.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Such an interesting region. Well, Ted, I know we're kind of coming to an end here, but I wanted to get a little bit of your final thoughts in regards to publishing. I know that you decided to self-publish this book, Frozen in Time. So how are you finding that whole process? I know it can be, pretty grueling, but really in the long run, most authors are really happy that they go that way.
Well, I'm very happy that I went that way. Author House, of course, has published both of my books. I've used the same team, happened to be Team Pearl, at Author House. They just do a tremendous job for me in the book. And you've seen copies of the book as professional as anything you're going to find coming out of the commercial houses in New York and elsewhere. But I have to tell you, in all candor, writing the book is the easy part.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
it's marketing and selling.
Promotion. Yeah, advertising.
Yes, and that's where you... You and Irene and the people over at Reader Views, I mean, you did my video for me, which is just fantastic. I'm getting a lot of compliments on the video. Mm-hmm. People absolutely love it. And the interview, the other interview, not this one,
mm-hmm.
and the review of the book, it's that kind of support that the independent author really needs, because that's the only way we have to get the word out. And of course, there are the websites. One of the things that's really been helpful is that Amazon is probably more than any other seller out there being very aggressive in helping the independent writer and the author sell their books, because I know they've made a site available for each of my books where I can upload my biography, I can upload my my video. They have other information about the book there. People are uploading their reviews of the book, and basically the Amazon site right now is almost my own personal website. And mm-hmm. if people decide they like the book, they can just buy it right there.
I know we were talking about that before we got on air today, that Amazon really, really is doing some amazing stuff for authors. And so I definitely encourage our listeners to go to Amazon and have a look at all of the information that you've put up there. As well as Author House, you have a site, or at least a page on the Author House.
Yes, there's a page on the Author House that has a little biography, something about me, something about the book, and then there's a preview of the book
mm-hmm.
on the Author House site.
That's great. So are you writing anything else? What's going on at this point? Are you just taking a break and then doing promotions for Frozen in Time?
I'm working primarily now on trying to sell Frozen in Time. You know, that's the first question that everybody asks me. What is your next book? So, and here it is, apparently the last question. I will tell you that in both cases, I had, the night before I started writing, I had no idea I was going to wake up the next morning and start writing a novel.
Mm-hmm. So they know you can't say. It could be tomorrow.
It could be tomorrow. I'll let you know when I wake up.
Well, you're kind of on a roll with a book a year, so your readers are definitely going to be expecting something in 2011, I'm sure.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Well, great. I know you're getting some really great reviews for Frozen in Time, so congratulations. And I just want to really thank you for talking with us today and sharing your thoughts and giving us a little bit of a lesson on Antarctica. And I just wish all the best to you, Ted.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I really appreciate it.
Great. Did you have any final last words that you wanted to share with your listeners?
No, I just hope that they enjoy the book as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, and you take care.
All right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You bet, Ted.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, listeners, that's been Ted Cohen, or Dr. Theodore Cohen. His new book, Frozen in Time, Murder at the Bottom of the World, is out now on shelves. And as mentioned, Amazon has it, as well as all online booksellers. And I'm sure that you can order it through your online bookstore. So check that out, too, and support your local book economy. So anyway, I want to thank you so much for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. It's been a wonderful day here talking with Ted. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.